Hello and welcome to the Yale Press podcast addendum interview with Jay Perini, the author of Why Poetry Matters. I'm your host, Chris Gondek. This is the full interview conducted on March 27th, 2008. An edited version was originally part of episode 14 of the show. Jay Perini, thanks for taking time to talk to Yale University Press today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
There are probably quite a few people in the world who might be interested in poetry, but find tackling a poem to be quite daunting, you know, given the language a poet uses and the topics a poet writes about. And what advice would you give one of those people?
Well, you know, I don't find poetry as intimidating as most people do because I've spent a lot of time with it. And I think that the way to approach poetry is as pleasure. You know, people always enjoy listening to music, say Bob Dylan or, you know, James Taylor, Simon and Garfunkel. You know, there's real poetry in that kind of music, and it's extremely accessible. And the truth is, a great deal of the poetic tradition, going back to the ancient Greeks, right up through the 20th century, is pretty accessible. I mean, anyone can read Robert Frost, for example. A fifth grader can read Robert Frost and get intense pleasure from the language and the shape of the poem on the page. So I think that just getting some experience with some of the poets that are not too difficult is probably the best way to go. And anyone who likes music, I think, will like poetry if they give it any chance at all.
Well, we talked about men like James Taylor and Bruce Springsteen. Isn't that really where the genesis of the term lyric poetry comes from, being able to accompany yourself to music?
Sure. You know, the ancient poets would recite lyric poems to the sound of the lyre. And so that's what, hence the word lyric. I mean, poetry is essentially musical language, and so it's. And W. H. Auden once defined poetry as memorable language, but I think I'd put the word musical in there. It's language. It's a system of linked sounds, and it appeals to the ear. It appeals to the senses, and it stays in the head. Poetry is quite wonderful that way. It's like songs, stick with you all day long when you hear a good song. A good poem stays in your head forever.
So where do you think this hesitation comes from, some people wanting to tackle poetry? I remember my grandfather, who passed away in the 90s, because it was part of his curriculum growing up and he had to memorize poetry, there were poems that he could still remember as he was moving into his 80s that he learned when he was a little boy. And you don't really get that much anymore. Why all of a sudden have we kind of like, has poetry not become such an important part of our culture?
No, the fault lies with modernism, when poetry became very self-consciously learned and difficult. Sometimes very, very good poets, such as Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, Wallace Stevens, nevertheless wrote poems that were, as I said, self-consciously difficult. And there's been a tradition in 20th century poetry of poetry that is obscure. I think this has, in many ways, gone against the mainstream of poetry, which flows from the storytelling Greeks through the great Roman storytelling poets right to the present. And so I think that readers have been put off by this difficult strain in modernism, which has never been the mainstream. I mean, Wordsworth is very accessible. Coleridge is very accessible. Robert Frost is accessible. Right up to the present, anybody could pick up a poem by, say, Mary Oliver. And millions do and find it extremely accessible and entertaining. Billy Collins is another good example. Poetry is mainly quite accessible. It's only these exceptions. But the problem is, school teachers have focused on a lot of this hard poetry, difficult poetry, even college teachers, and I think that's had a very bad effect on poetry.
The name of the book is Why Poetry Matters, and I'd like to take a step back really to the beginning. You mentioned the ancient Greeks, and it obviously mattered very much to them because men like Plato and Aristotle and even the Romans had very divergent views about what poetry should mean to the Republic. Could you talk a little bit about the controversies of poetry really starting back as far as Plato?
Well, you know, in his writing, Plato said he would banish poets from his ideal republic. And his reason for this was, well, twofold, I'd say, mainly. Firstly, poets were liars. That is, language is a representation of an imitation. I mean, in Platonic philosophy, what's real is what is sort of the ideal table in heaven, let's say. There is no such thing as a real table. So there's only the ideal form or the idea of the table in heaven. So when you see a table on this planet, it's a kind of inferior reproduction of God's perfect table. And then when a poet describes or a painter paints a table, it's a copy of a copy. And so Plato argued that poetry was at too many removes from reality to be useful. And so that's one reason he wanted to get rid of poets. But I think what really lay behind his antipathy for poets was his belief that poets are somehow waylaying the young, teaching them to enjoy the pleasures of life, sexual pleasures, wine, good food, beautiful nature, walking in the woods, romance. And he thought that this distracted young people from their duties as citizens. And so it was a kind of a puritanical response to the pleasures of language in poetry. And so you get this argument running right through the ancients. Aristotle, Horace, and Longinus, for example, take up some of the challenge put down by Plato and argue against him. And then we have the cudgels picked up again in the Renaissance. We see Sir Philip Sidney defending poetry. And many poets, right up through Shelley, defending the art of poetry from those who wanted to put it down for various reasons, but mostly the reasons outlined by Plato in his original anti-poetic writings.
So in that, you get into later on in your book discussions of really 20th century philosophy. You know, it's easy to say that poetry is just an imitation because at the core poetry is language. And up until really the 20th century, everybody more or less thought language always referred to something, that you couldn't just have language in and of itself, that you were pointing towards a separate reality. That changed in the 20th century. How did that change and how did that affect really our concept of poetry?
Well, the 20th century philosophers, maybe even beginning with some of the late 19th century philosophers, even going back to Nietzsche and earlier, many of them believed, and I think it's true, that language is the key to philosophical understanding. And when philosophers such as Wittgenstein came along, a major 20th century thinker, the whole question of language was thrown into question. Wittgenstein was trying to understand how words connected to things and how so much cannot be said, and he wanted to stick to what could be said. Very little could be said with any kind of verification. Once you try to verify truth in a philosophical way, you soon discover that you can't really verify poetic language. Poets make statements which are not true in a philosophical or logical sense. And so there's been a tremendous discussion in the 20th century and early 21st century still about the nature of truth, the nature of language as it relates to truth. In other words, what's the connection between words and things? I think it's been discovered that there's a very tenuous connection between words and things. In his later writings, Wittgenstein essentially comes to the conclusion that, you know, we create our own realities in language, and essentially we declare a certain truth. This is what poets have known all along. The poet Theodore Rettke once wrote, "I summon a vision and declare it pure." Essentially, that's what poets have done from Homer and Virgil and Dante through T.S. Eliot and contemporary poets. They summon a vision, and they declare it true and pure, and readers then test that truth, not against some philosophical or quasi-logical testing, but they test it on their own pulse. Does this feel true to me? When a poet describes a landscape, does this seem right or wrong? Is this landscape a spiritual landscape, an inner landscape? And it usually is. Poetry is language, but it's a very specialized kind of language. It's a language of metaphor. And it's not the language of logic.
Using metaphor and being aware of it and symbolism is not something that I think it's fair to say our culture does really well anymore. Can you give a sense of what poetry means or how a love of poetry can help develop this metaphorical knowledge in people?
You know, Robert Frost has a wonderful essay called Education by Poetry. And in that essay, he argues that if you're not educated properly in the language of metaphor, in the operations of metaphorical thinking, you're not safe to be let loose in the world because you don't know how far you can take a metaphor and how far you can't take a metaphor. You know, just let me take an obvious example, the war on terror. I mean, this is, you know, to what extent is this a war on terror? Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty. Now President Bush declares a war on terror. Well, you know, I think it's a misunderstanding of the nature of metaphor. I mean, the word terror, I mean, is essentially a symbol. It's a very abstract symbol. Are we really making a war on terror itself here? It's very confusing. And so I think that, in fact, when you're educated in how to make comparisons, that's all metaphors are, comparisons, I think your mind becomes sharper. Poets have actually razor-sharp minds, and they follow their comparisons over many stanzas in a poem. You take a metaphor and you elaborately work it through. That's called a conceit. And poetry teaches readers how to think comparatively, comparing this thing to that thing, how to think symbolically. And if you're not educated in these particular analogical operations, I really don't think you are safe in the world, because you're going to be easily duped by the media. You're going to be gullible. You're not going to be able to have a critical attitude toward all different branches of knowledge. So I think the basis for all thinking is metaphorical. Poetry is metaphorical thinking. And so training in poetry is tremendously useful for any citizen, for anyone who wants to work through the world in an intellectual manner.
That is a utilitarian case for poetry. But let's talk about aesthetics. Does poetry really have to be useful to matter, or can poetry be of consequence just because of the beauty of the language?
I don't think it can be of very great significance just because it's beautiful. I mean, sure, I mean, one can love a phrase and say, yes, that's pretty. One can look at a painting and say, yes, that's pretty. One can hear a song and say, yes, that's pretty, or very, very beautiful, say. But I think at some point, beauty becomes truth. Truth becomes beauty. And so Keats understood that connection between beauty and truth. And I think when a poem becomes really significant, you're looking at a situation where the language is, yes, beautiful, but it's also saying something true, and saying it in ways that make that truth come home to the reader. And so I think that you really do need to have both the true aspect of the poem, as well as the beautiful aspect of the poem, for it to lift off into major work.
Does that mean that truth in and of itself, if you have a poem that may not be particularly skilled as far as poetic writing but reaches to a greater truth, would you value that more than the obverse, which would be beauty but not necessarily authentic?
You know, I think that there are a lot of truths out there that are put so badly that people can't even recognize them as true. They don't recognize them as significant or memorable. I mean, for a truth to come home to somebody, it has to take on a kind of palpable quality. It has to resonate. And for that to happen, you do have to have some marriage of truth with beauty. I mean, you can read read true things and they make no impact on you. But when you read them phrased in the way poets phrase them, somehow the expression really does matter. And also the part of the beauty is in the precision of the expression. I mean, I think the things cannot be separated very easily. I find something very, very beautiful, even in a philosophical essay, when it's written with extraordinary precision. The precision of poetry. You read the work of Emerson, for example. He's a sort of touchstone philosopher for me. I think that he's saying true things in ways that are so astonishingly original and fresh that they take on a whole new reality.
Although the book is called Why Poetry Matters, and that would seem to point out that you're trying to reach out to people to make them realize how important it is to their life, perhaps in against saying a utilitarian way, there is very much a spiritual element through this book. Poetry is obviously very important to you as a person. But while I was reading it, I was wondering about that very question of spirituality. Can someone who's a dedicated materialist, who really doesn't give a toss about the spiritual world, really get as powerful a reaction out of poetry as someone else?
I think poetry leads anyone who takes it seriously into realms that could be called spiritual, because it takes us into realms of memory. It takes us into realms which are trans-time. In other words, it takes us out of time. And as soon as you're moving out of time, you're moving out of the material world. And I don't think that the rigid, strict materialist who wants to stick to this world in every way is going to have as deep an appreciation of poetry, is going to be as moved by the potentials to be moved that are there in the poem. I mean, I define spirituality, of course, very, very generally and broadly here. I'm not saying it means you have necessarily believe in God or subscribe to some particular doctrine. I use the word spirit in the sense of the human spirit, and I think there is a deep brooding presence, a kind of what Emerson called a universal soul, that we all connect to in our most elevated moments. And I think poetry keeps gesturing in the direction that elevated or beautiful or ultimately true identification with the world spirit. I know it sounds very grand and so forth, but it's not. I mean, I think it's there when a poet writes about the experiencing the sunlight at dawn, glistening on the grass, which is wet with dew. And I think, you know, we connect to all senses of dawn and awakening and sparkling, and we understand what it means to be alive in the moment in the way all creatures, great and small, so to speak, have understood the beauty of, say, a field at dawn, dew on the grass. I mean, those kinds of experiences have a certain universality. And the poets write about these things in ways that connect us to other minds, to other places in time. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. And when you're saying that, it makes me think that you're setting it up really as, going back to the beginning of this interview, kind of the opposite of what Plato is saying. Plato was saying the poetry takes you further away from, I guess, the real truth. And you're saying that poetry, if read skillfully, actually takes you closer to the real truth.
I mean, I really think that's true. You know, Wallace Stevens calls it of seeing things exactly as they are. Wallace Stevens has another phrase that I quote in my book, description is revelation. And I think simply to describe an experience, which might be the experience of a pond in the woods, might be the experience of a child playing in the garden, might be the experience of a woman combing her hair, but to describe an experience like that is to take us somewhere from the kind of hazy world of everyday thinking into a kind of precise image which will be revelatory. And what does it mean to reveal things, to be prophetic, to see beyond the real, or to go deeper into the real?
So what was the first poem to make a significant impact on you?
Well, the first poem that ever made a deep impact on me was Robert Frost, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. When I was in ninth grade, a teacher said to me, here, take this poem home, Jay, read it, and write a paper. And I thought, oh my God, I'm screwed. My life is ruined. And I took that poem home. I'd never really read poetry before. And I was so astonished by the language, you know, when he describes the woods are lovely, dark, and deep. When he talked about the only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake, I thought, my word, can you imagine that it's possible to express something so freshly, something so true? And I began my sort of journey through Robert Frost, and I was so taken with so many of these poems, you know, the way that crow shook down on me, you know, a dust of snow from a hemlock tree, you know, has changed my life, you know, through that kind of language, kind of precision of the revelation. And I realized that as all human consciousness is a sequence of these images, these very concrete and palpable images, which when strung together create a life of the mind, and when gone into deeply and organized deeply in the way poems organize reality, essentially create a life of the spirit, connecting us to everybody else and freshening our awareness of ourselves in the world. I think there's just nothing for it. I think that to live a life fully, you need to be attentive to language and reality in the way poets are. Poetry does offer readers a way into this reality or these multiple realities.
Jay Perini, author of Why Poetry Matters, thanks for taking time to talk to Yale University Press today.
Well, I'm very glad to be with you today.
And that was Jay Perini talking about his book, Why Poetry Matters, which is published by Yale University Press. For more information about this and other titles, go to the website, www.yalebooks.com. Copyright 2008, Yale University Press, all rights reserved.